This is Everyday We're Hustling. I'm Miranda Campbell. More and more, young people are trying to turn their creative projects into careers. Getting this going involves struggle, commitment, and a whole lot of work. Everyday we're hustling. Our guests work in different creative fields, but what they have in common is this hustle. Pursuing a creative career means juggling artistic and economic demands. It's a constant balancing act, and the road to making a living isn't always clear. So, how are young people managing all this? A lot of young people today want to work in creative fields. These industries often have a less diverse profile than the labor market as a whole. This episode, we discuss making space through alternative ways of living and creating. How do you carve out new opportunities where they don't exist? What are young people doing to make the creative industries a more accessible and fair place to earn a living? Marie Gerge is a writer and art critic. She was the 2016 recipient of the editorial residency at Canadian Art Magazine. Marie came into her residency at Canadian Art well-versed in publishing. As an undergraduate art history student at the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design, she co-founded Crit Paper, a magazine focused on contemporary criticism. Marie, thanks for joining us here today.
Of course.
So when people ask you what you do, what do you tell them?
I say that I'm a writer and an editor. That's been the predominant part of my practice and what I do for the past maybe 3 or 4 years. I didn't become comfortable with saying that until I first got Tinder a few years ago and people would ask me what I did, and I didn't feel like explaining that I had been feeling imposter syndrome about how I define my practice. And so the more I said it, the more I became confident in that identification, even with all of the insecurities that I felt.
Were there other things going on career-wise that helped you feel a greater level of comfort around that imposter syndrome? Or do you still think that's something you grapple with?
I'm 1,000% still grappling with it. I just began an editorial residency at Canadian Art a few weeks ago, and I feel like I'm getting closer to finding my voice as a writer, and I'm getting closer to zoning in on my interests and my objectives and my process as a writer. And so even with that relative increased comfort, I still find myself in this place being like, am I good enough to be here? Maybe I should go back to my J school notes and brush up. So yeah, I feel like because you can't study art criticism in school, I don't think there are really any set paths into art writing. And I think most people sort of arrive at it through other routes, but you don't learn how to be an art critic when you study art history.
Right. So because of this lack of set paths that has existed into art criticism, do you feel like that world has been insular in the past and kind of limited in access in terms of who gets to be in it?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, getting to study art and art history is already such an immense privilege. I come from an immigrant family and a diaspora community where an immense amount of value is placed on white collar jobs. And I have this privilege of having had parents who were at first skeptical, but eventually supportive. But then I also had to come up against a lot of really traditional sort of resistance to this deviation.
While you were at NASCAD, you started a paper called Crit.
Yes. I was in my third year of art history, and I was really frustrated with the lack of publishing opportunities for people who were still trying to figure out how to write. NASCAD didn't have a student paper like most universities do. And my peers who were in the same boat and I just weren't in a place where we could publish anywhere, really. We just, we were still figuring things out. And so we got together with a student union and got some money from them to start this paper. And this was back in 2012. There was an absence, and so we devised something for ourselves to remedy that. We don't have a style guide. Because we don't have a style guide and because we don't publish ads, people can say and do whatever they want. And so oftentimes the essays and the criticism take on forms that other print publications wouldn't be conducive to, or that they would be resistant to publish because it's not what their readership is accustomed to. And that's something that I've been noticing. I've been tuning into that contrast a little bit more as I've been at Canadian Art, when I hear conversations about like, oh, we can't do this. That's not what our readers know of us, or you know, whatever, something to that tune. And I'm like, oh, like we can do whatever the fuck. Can I swear?
Yeah.
We can do whatever the fuck we want.
And you mentioned in the early days getting some money from the student union at NASCAD, like a little bit of seed funding maybe to get your start. How do you keep the thing running from the financial side? Do you fundraise for each issue to be printed, or how do you get those dollars together?
Well, so it was only the first issue that was published by the student union. And then in our first 2 years, we sort of, it was a combination of fundraising, Indiegogo or Kickstarter or whatever. And we would throw fundraiser parties that our friends would generously agree to play or to DJ. And so we would raise just enough money to publish, and we'd throw a few of these parties per year. But this was when we were still students. And then in our third year, we struck up a partnership with the Kyber Center for the Arts, which is an artist-run center in Halifax that's been around for a long time, that's very well loved. And in our third year, we got a programming grant from like a Halifax-based art council. Okay. through the Kyber. Mm-hmm. And so that's the thing, because we don't pay writers, and because Crit is free, we don't qualify for a lot of grants out there. Mm-hmm. And so we've had to sort of, you know, figure out other ways to make do. And so a substantial part of that came from fundraising and the generosity of friends.
Can you tell us about your editorial residency at Canadian Art?
It's an annual residency that they've been doing since, I think, 2009 or 2010. And I had been living in Halifax during another residency in the fall. And I was getting really restless in Halifax and thought that I would move to Toronto and kind of just like figure it out. And so about a month, I applied at the beginning of April, and about a month later, I took the train from Halifax to here. I hadn't heard back from them and was just like, whatever, obviously I'm not going to get it. I can't believe I thought I stood a chance. Whatever, it's fine.
Your imposter syndrome crept back in there in those moments of not hearing, do you think?
Oh my God, absolutely. Yes. But I think that for the first time ever, I was totally okay with it. I wasn't distressed. I think I'd just grown so accustomed to having that it wasn't a source of anxiety in the same way that it had been for me before. And so I was just like, yeah, whatever, I'm not going to get it. And on the train ride, I got a phone call from them letting me know that they wanted me to do it. And so it was just serendipity that it lined up. And I've been there for about 4 weeks.
How have you handled the shift between working on your own projects and then working 9 to 5 at a magazine?
I haven't figured it out yet. I find myself totally wiped out at the end of each workday. I find it, I mean, it's pretty fast paced, and there's like a healthy amount of pressure to meet deadlines and you know, whatever, it's the publishing industry. That's the way that it works. But, I'm not used to like sitting in one spot for 8 hours and so I'm, you know, trying to configure, like, still 4 weeks in, my sleeping schedule, my diet, my energy levels, like, go bust at around two or like one or two. And I'm just like useless for a few hours. And so I stay later to compensate for those few lost hours. And so, yeah, I don't feel like I'm at a point yet where I have very much of a life outside of that. And it's totally okay. I'm into this kind of like, you know, completely immersive experience.
Does your day then continue with art-related socializing? Is that taxing?
I've tried to be gentler with myself and to listen to myself more. On some nights I feel like going to openings, and on other nights I can recognize that I wouldn't be able to entertain small talk, or that I wouldn't be able to be present or genuine. And so that's been like a huge thing for me over the past couple of years.
Yeah.
Just to like be more conscientious and intent on self-care, and also to sometimes just say no, which is another thing that's always been really difficult.
What do you hope to most gain out of your time in this editorial residency?
I'm trying to figure out how to be an ally. An artist once told me that when you're in a setting where your voice is listened to in any capacity, that it's your responsibility to be a creek of your privilege and to channel it to other people who don't have access to what you have access to at that given moment. And so I want to see this time as a way for me to learn how to write about experiences other than my own lived experience as a woman of color. Although I recognize, I mean, I'm not marginalized anymore. Like, I've been institutionally sanctioned by having done residencies, and like, you know, it was a really frightening thing. And something that I want to keep at the foreground all the time, to like not allow that to like dull my anti-oppression politics, or so that I would never become deluded that everything's okay or that the work is done. Or I never want to lose sight of that.
To be what you said, to be a creek of your privilege. What about crit paper? Do you see that continuing? You know, you said you make it twice a year, budget and time allowing. Mm-hmm. Do you have a goal to keep that paper alive, or do you feel like at a certain point it will have served its function and die out?
I feel like I've learned all of the things that I set out to learn from it, and so it's no longer a vehicle for learning in the same way that it was. But I think I really wish that I hadn't second-guessed myself as much as I had. I really wish, yeah, I wish that imposter syndrome was something that we had, you know, identified and nipped it in the bud. Although, I mean, I don't know if that would have been possible. It's like, you know, very much like a gendered thing that women who are raised in patriarchal societies are bound to internalize. And so if I could say something to my younger self, I think that would be one of the top things that I would tell myself, that I have agency, and that I can do whatever the fuck I want.
April Yarmo has played bass in Hooded Fang since 2007. With musical collaborator Daniel Lee, she started Phaedra and Tonka Puma, as well as independent label Daps Records. In September 2015, April wrote an article for Exclaim magazine criticizing Calgary rock band Viet Cong for its name choice. She subsequently organized a panel called Music, Racism, Power, and Privilege 101 at the Music Gallery in Toronto to address issues of racism in the mostly white indie music scene. April is committed to demystifying music making and creating accessibility within scenes. We spoke to April about balancing art with making a living, while also considering questions of inclusion and representation. Hi, April. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Miranda.
So you started playing bass in the band Hooded Fang in 2007, and you guys now have a new record out called Venus on Edge. Can you tell us about making that record?
Most of our Hooded Fang songs and records starts off with Daniel having an idea and laying them down, and then we recorded all the instrumentals in Dan's dad's basement right before we went on tour on the West Coast. We kind of work better when we have a deadline.
Mm-hmm.
So our deadline was, we're going on the road, and so we have to finish this. And then we had the instrumentals for a whole year because Daniel just had a singer's block, I guess. Didn't know how to sing them. We played them, trying to worked it out. We played it like live in the West Coast. And then a year later, finally, we're like, okay, we're going to buckle down. And then Dan and I just locked ourselves in his apartment for like a week and just pounded out all the lyrics. Then he recorded them all, and that was it.
I'm hearing a theme of just locking yourself in a space for a week to get things done. Is that part of your creative process?
sometimes it is. I think that I and my bandmates, we tend to work under pressure quite well. So deciding to just focus entirely on one task in a condensed period of focus time really helps.
So you have this new record out this year. You've been playing with Hooded Fang for nearly 10 years. So how do you explain the longevity of Hooded Fang coming up on a decade of music?
Peter Pan complex. Mm. you know, our approach to writing music, I mean, first of all, we just love doing it. Just like playing music and touring is, it's like an interesting sociological experiment. I feel like my first tour was really different from my second tour, different from my third tour, and so on. And each time, it sounds so cheesy, but I just learned something about myself and the world around me and how I want to be and how I think things should be. And it just changed every time, and my understanding of that just changed. I would say that is the biggest evolution for me. Mm. Just like the different tours and how it affected me as a person.
Traditionally, I think people might have been expected to quit at a certain point, right? That you need to, I don't know what, stop doing that or grow up, right?
For sure.
But you're talking about growing up through music on the road in different kinds of ways. That doesn't sound like a Peter Pan complex.
It can appear that way, yeah. But for sure not. It's yeah. a, you know, I mean, if I had a full-time job, like let's say I had thousands of dollars a year.
Sometimes full-time jobs pay more than that.
Thousands and thousands and thousands,
Some thousands of dollars a year. Yeah.
I would be spending it on travel and food and rent and having a good time. So you can sort of eliminate the need for that money and think of other ways to do it. Because right now I get to travel, and it's my actually one of my favorite ways to travel, because I go straight to the places I would be hanging out in with people that I would want to be hanging out with. You know, I like go to Taiwan. I go straight to the place that there will be an audience for my music. And now I have friends in Taiwan, and that's cool. It's a great way to meet the locals. You know, making my minimum amount of money covers my food expenses. And I mean, rent, there's ways to find affordable rent in Toronto, and a lot of people sublet their places when they're on tour. I have an alternative set up right now. I just think that as a society, we are definitely more progressive, and we are reverting back to quote unquote old ways of doing things. There's like microbreweries now. People are into farmers markets. And while it's still probably most accessible for, you know, young single people or wealthy families, the idea of making things local and I think it ties in to just like the idea of doing things simpler. And there are things that are turning up, like Bun's Trading Zone, where you're trading things. You're just eliminating the need for money. You're like, I need shoes and you need a can of paint so we can trade. And that's awesome.
So how are you negotiating living in an increasingly expensive city?
Well, up until last year, I was working part-time jobs. And again, lucky to be on tour half the time, because when I'm on tour, I don't have to pay for rent. But I was very lucky to have been invited last year by these friends of mine who have a home. They're really like established in the city, and they have two kids, and they invited me to live with them in exchange for helping out with their kids sometimes. So that is an amazing trade because I have a good relationship with the kids and the parents who I've been friends with for a while. And in a way, it's like helping me as an artist. So if I feel like there could be a real other program or system in the city, because I'm pretty sure a lot of these homes have enough space for one more person. And this isn't the first I've heard of this. I've heard of other families doing this where like they have a basement and they'll give it, you know, to a suitable person in exchange for helping out with their kids. In the Philippines, you can just run over to your neighbor's house, no problem, or leave your kids with your neighbors, no problem. You know, so or they have really big families and grandmothers, aunts, uncles, cousins, they're all helping raise the children. In a place like Toronto, where it is very nuclear family centric, you need that extra support system to raise your kids, or it'll be really burdensome for you. So I think there's just creative ways to eliminate the need for exchange of money. I'm not saying to eliminate it altogether, but I think that for certain people who want to make that work, they can.
You have a master's degree in education, and, you know, a more traditional route would be to work full-time as a teacher.
It's true.
But you've chosen not to do that. But yet you're very active in local scenes and all ages scenes and doing educational kind of work in other platforms.
Up until 2 years ago, I ran a play school for 6 years. This amazing woman, Anna Hill, friend of mine, she is also who I live with right now. She invited me to run a home daycare from her house, and the play school sort of just spiraled from there. She was amazing. She was like, what are your ideal working conditions? How much do you want to get paid? And I said, 3 days a week. I want my two other artist friends to take the other 2 days, and we want to get paid, you know, $20 an hour. She was like, okay, done. So we had five families bring their kids to the house, because at the time, full day kindergarten wasn't in effect. So kindergarten in the morning only went until 11:30, and we were with these kids from 11:30 to 5:30. And we basically developed the curriculum around our interests and the things we thought was important and found interesting and the interests of those kids. And part of that was, oh, like, why would we want to stay indoors all day? Like, let's go explore the city. So we would go on public transportation. We would visit all these cultural institutions. And everyone was like happy. One kid in particular was super into the TTC. So we would just take long rides on the subway because we could. And all the parents were cool with that. And we just evolved into this like play school. At one point, I think we had like 45 to 60 families that we were working with. But I was developing the curriculum for all the little groups.
You're also doing this work at the community level in the music scene. How did that come about?
There's this place called Kapisanan, Philippine Center for Arts and Culture. I'm Filipino. And back in the day, my bandmate Daniel, when he was a teenager growing up in Toronto, you could go see a band for $5 or for a canned soup, you know, at Lee's Palace. But there's not that much of that going on these days in Toronto. So we're like, oh, why don't we just start like an all ages series? We know all these musicians. They want to play for younger people and younger people want to see them. So let's just try it out. And we did. Again, being musicians ourselves, we had a network of people that we knew and that we could just ask to play.
And now you also run your own record label, Daps Records. Do you see that kind of as an extension of your involvement in a DIY scene here in Toronto and kind of fostering that scene in the business end?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's a tough industry. You know, we've been in it for a while. I got to learn a lot of the business side of things. And it's really tough because it makes sense, but a lot of it is driven by profits. It's a very capitalist way of working and doing things. So that being said, a lot of the information is also very private, like how to get your music out, which contacts to send your music to. It's all very private. You have to pay for a publicist. You have to pay for a booking agent. You have to pay for a manager. There's no one really like helping you out. And if they are, it's because they want to eventually get paid. I think it's important for everyone to get paid for sure. But I think there has to be, in general, with anything you do, there has to be some kind of flexibility. And there's not very much flexibility in this capitalist structure. So with our label, so one of our goals is to put out bands. And I mean, we're not going to try and make them famous or anything, but just to empower them with the know-hows of certain parts of the industry. Because a lot of bands don't know. They just want to make music, of course. And they have no idea where to begin to set up a tour or... you should print your CDs out at this place and mail it out to all these college and radio stations. You know, no one tells anyone that. Just like very simple, basic knowledge. We just want to like give to bands that we find interesting.
Yeah. But you're also distributing that knowledge widely through your website, not just through the bands that you work with. So you have on your website DIY tips, which I imagine you've gathered through your 10 plus years as a musician. Basics like registering your music so you can get paid through royalties if they happen, planning your release schedule, digital distribution, press, booking, playing in the US.
Yeah, for sure. Especially if bands are willing to put the work in themselves and are not trying to be, you know, Beyonce or something or Arcade Fire. There's a disclaimer at the top that says there's millions of bands. Don't have your heart broken if you don't make it or if no one likes you. Everyone has their own taste, which is why I love the all-ages punk scene in Toronto. I think the all-ages scene went away because there's no money in it. Mm. You just need someone who's interested in it and who's in it for the idea and for the community. And that, again, going back to the all-ages punk scene, they do it because they love music, they love punk, they love doing things themselves, they're anti-capitalists. To them, it's a given that their scene is anti homophobic, anti-racist, anti-sexist, anti-ableist, and you go to these shows and the kids are like, it's like, you know, United Colors of Benetton and it's so pansexual. There's like a trans woman who's drumming and a Latino guy who's singing and a woman who's screaming, like, you know, the representation is not even a question in this scene. It just happens so naturally because they are saying, these are our values. This is what's not welcome. And so, you know, like, you cannot be racist here. You cannot be sexist. You cannot be homophobic. You cannot discriminate anyone for any reason unless they're being a jerk. And people know that, and so they feel like, oh, I can be safe in this space.
We can learn a lot from young artists and cultural workers about the process of making a living from creative work. But the products they're creating are also exciting and innovative. Cultural correspondent Jesse Cumming reviews youth creativity in music, film, visual art, literature, and design. This episode, Jesse discusses the work of Vancouver-based illustrator Heather Kai Smith.
Creative work is rarely a full-time endeavor. It's frequently balanced out by other work. For some practitioners, their double lives, or triple or quadruple lives, are separate. For others, these multiple pursuits can blend together. This is true in the case of Vancouver-based illustrator and scholar Heather Kai Smith, whose practice moves between illustration, drawing, animation, design, video, and historical research. Across all these different types of work, Smith engages with formal experimentation while investigating the histories of feminist art, labor, and perception. Smith's illustrations are deceptively rich. They are more often than not images of human figures sketched in black and white with thin lines. They manage to be both mysterious and evocative. They hint at stories we don't see but can sense. Her earlier work, like the Shadow Diving series, frequently evokes the sensibilities of pop artist Roy Lichtenstein and his use of comic strip melodrama. It suggests a story without any context. The Shadow Diving series features some of Smith's most colorful work. While she currently favors black and white, her contemporary illustrations are no less dynamic and ambitious. With several recent drawings, Smith seems to challenge the limits of a static image and what happens when an illustration moves between mediums. Over an impressive series of untitled, small-scale drawings, Smith introduces a glitch aesthetic that serves to distort and warp the faces and bodies of her figures. She embraces the influence of these modern technological phenomenons, but reimagines them through the artist's classic tools of ink and paper. Concepts of media theory and visual culture are obvious influences on such work. These recent drawings seem to arrive with an understanding that they are themselves images, that they exist in a world of images. Smith's work quite literally pushes boundaries as figures spill out of their frames. Alongside illustrations and videos, one key element of Smith's work in animation is her historical research. The artist is invested in establishing a framework for her own practice. It's a lineage that she can align herself with while also pushing back against. Part of this work has involved fostering and supporting communities of like-minded practitioners. Before leaving to Vancouver to complete a Master's of Applied Arts at Emily Carr University, Smith was an active member of Calgary's vibrant and vital Quick Draw Animation Society, a hub for animation production and education. It was at Quick Draw that Smith first developed her Great Women Animators project. It's an undertaking that has since grown into a multifaceted and ever-evolving research initiative. Initially presented over 5 weeks, the individual courses included surveys on topics such as pioneers of early animation, the studio animator in context, and psychedelic and experimental animators. The project covered early greats like Lottie Renninger from Germany and pioneers of computer animation like Lillian Schwartz. The project also served to reintroduce collaborators at risk of being written out of history, like Norman McLaren's regular partner Evelyn Lambert. The courses were led for both practitioners and general audiences. Each week's lecture and screening was accompanied by a hand-drawn and photocopied zine, including relevant scholarship and other essays. Smith's recent work is proof of her sustained engagement with archival research and its importance on her practice. One such example is A Woman Comes Into the Room, a recent animation piece that is condensed into a fleeting 1 minute and 30 seconds. Structured around a found recording of poet Alice Notley reading the title poem, the piece is strange, elegant, and altogether mesmerizing. We watch as women's faces, torsos, and full figures appear and disappear, always drawn in Smith's signature thin strokes. We also see the outline of doorways as they expand and collapse, playing with our perception. Are these entrances or exits? One key word in appreciating Smith's broad and diverse output is continuity. Her drawings blur together as if they exist in their own fully realized world. Her animations and other illustrations exist in dialogue with art history. Smith's work is often drawn on paper before it circulates online. At the same time, Smith scours the internet as part of her scholarly research or for the Great Women Animators Project. These online inspirations then lead back to the artist's studio practice. Just like Smith's work itself, the lines that connect her overarching practice are subtle, but unexpected, exciting, and committed.
For information about our guests, check the show notes for this episode or our website, everydaywearehustling.com. Everyday We're Hustling is produced by Jesse Cumming. Our program is recorded and edited by Max Cotter, with graphic and web design by Lucy Woke, and music by Adam Wado. I'm your host, Marietta Campbell, assistant professor in the School of Creative Industries at Ryerson University. Everyday We're Hustling is funded by the Creative Innovation Grant at Ryerson University.